I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. This was Wake Up Week among the Democrats nominating a presidential candidate. Some woke up cheering that Bernie Sanders looks like the choice of the people. Some woke up screaming in panic that the rebellion against the Clinton era is real, that their party has been dying for 4 years, that the end is near. The sound of battle has gone raw. Survival at stake, not just egos.
And I am not looking forward to a scenario where it comes down to Donald Trump with his nostalgia for the social order of the 1950s and Bernie Sanders with a nostalgia for the revolutionary politics of the 1960s. This is not about what coups were happening in the 1970s or 80s. This is about the future. This is about 2020.
Mayor Pete, taunting socialism in South Carolina this week, was extending the light dust up back in Nevada about capitalism. Michael Bloomberg, backhanding communism and Bernie Sanders.
You know what, Mr. Bloomberg, it wasn't you who made all that money. Maybe your workers played some role in that as well.
It's ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
The talk will be about isms, though the feeling that is surfacing may be more simply about money power in party politics in the country at large. We are tuning in this hour on the billionaire moment in 2020 politics, when Bernie Sanders' vilification of the super-rich is echoing everywhere. Anand Giridharadas has our keynote on what he is calling our 2020 referendum among and about the billionaires, about billionaireism. For the reporter and writer Giridharadas, who has worked for centrist institutions like Time Magazine and the New York Times, the light came in researching and interviewing the Bill Gates class of wealth and power. His best-selling book that came out of his awakening was Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Anand Giridharadas makes it a lens on politics, too.
You know, what I saw, very simply, was a contradiction between, on the one hand, a group of very, very wealthy and powerful people who were giving money back, doing nice things for people, giving away billions and billions of dollars, starting all these new modalities of social enterprise, social this, social that, social impact funds, going to Africa all the time, collecting all these, you know, these bankers collect all these bracelets from Africa to kind of signify every trip that they take over there to rescue people. And it seemed like we were living in this golden age of rich people trying to make a difference. But, you know, also, as you and I know, in that same time period, we were reading more and more about a parallel story, which was the story of those same, that same class of people, and in many cases, the same actual people, becoming the malefactors of wealth for a new generation. And I became curious about what the relationship was between the giving and the taking, between the helping and the hoarding.
Your book anticipated a kind of fault line in history, it now feels, and Bernie, to give him credit, put a name on it. The word was billionaire. And now, as you've written, they're everywhere, on the stage, behind the stage, under the stage, broadcasting the stage, the subject of the conversation on stage. Take us through your own noticing. Wait a sec, it's the billionaire moment.
I think as my reporting went on, it was very much shaped by the campaign of 2016. You know, forget Hillary versus Trump. The Bernie versus Hillary fight was a really profound argument. When Bernie Sanders became a challenger, you suddenly saw that there was this line that was being drawn between people who may have the kinds of good intentions Hillary Clinton had and may have the right policies, but who fundamentally are on the wrong side of a line of power. And in her case, are on that side because of some of their affiliations, who they raise money from, who they spend time with, who they choose to give speeches to. I think we forget what a culturally significant argument that was, that we all then were part of.
You're right on, Anand, but I got to admit, I didn't know at the time how badly she lost in New Hampshire 4 years ago. Bernie Sanders beat Hillary 60-40. That's doubly a landslide. Donald Trump beat the patrician heir, Jeb Bush, 4 or 5 to 1 wholesale rejection of what people had gotten used to.
You got to remember, Bernie won 22 states, you know, 21 in addition to that one. And as someone who spent time with Bernie for a big, long report in Time magazine last year, I got to tell you, Bernie winning 22 states is especially remarkable if you've ever hung out with Bernie or Larry David. This is someone who is almost anti-political in his being, who, you know, it's like every hand to shake is pain, who doesn't like to tell his personal story, who is not someone who kind of rolls with the times and adapts and rethinks things. Like, it's hard to think about someone less likely to win elections if you were making them in a lab. And this guy won 22 states against the dynasty in the Democratic Party. And you think, like, something's going on here. And I think the thing that was going on was naming an intuition that a lot of people had but hadn't articulated, which he helped them articulate, that this country was becoming more than unequal, more than unfair. It was becoming a country run anytime there was a fork in the road between what was good for money and what was good for people. It was becoming more and more a country run for what was good for money. And I think that is a profounder insight than the standard Democratic moaning about inequality or talking about people paying their fair share. This was an insight about power. And frankly, to put it very simply, I think the view Sanders articulated in 2016, which now I would say he and Elizabeth Warren both articulate in 2020, is some people need to be made less wealthy and less powerful than they are now in order for justice to be done and true prosperity, broad-based prosperity to flourish in America. And to be very clear, I do not think Hillary Clinton believed that. I don't think Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden believes that. This is a fundamental fault. This is the fundamental fault line. Win-winism or not win-winism. I have been persuaded through my reporting that in a situation like this with a maldistribution of power and resources as we have right now, there is no way to do right by most people without actually bringing some people down from extreme levels of power, wealth, and privilege. And I think that's a pretty tough sell in America that has become remarkably a much less tough sell.
The drama plays out on stage in each of these debates, including this week before South Carolina, for and against billionaires on stage. But at the center of it, Michael Bloomberg, looking like a deer in the headlights, completely shocked that not only people are taking deep swings at him, but that he has, in a certain sense, no answer, except that he spends his infinite money on good causes.
You know, he is an archetype. And he's a really good example because it's not, the giving is not fake the way it is for some people, right? This guy is genuinely giving a lot of money away. And I would say to better causes than a lot of people. His choice of causes is better than that of many people.
Right.
You know, genuinely interested in an approach to problem solving that, you know, it's true. You sometimes do not get that level of clarity and intelligence and certain public programs. So you could say a lot in defense of that approach, but this is a guy whose entire fortune is selling these terminals, technology, to a financial industry that is the industry that destroyed the American dream for working people, right? Whether in...
That's broad, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, you want to talk about who was it that came in, the corporate raiders that came in and put pressure to defund pensions, to shift pension plans around, just get rid of them altogether? Who were the consultants and people on Wall Street who put pressure to shift to dynamic scheduling? These were not companies themselves that wanted to become more cruel, right? There's a whole story, which I tell in the book, about the 1970s onward, a management revolution that made companies much more merciless, much more driven to procure bottle service public policy through lobbying that privately benefited them and not others. A lot of that was driven by the pressure from the investor class through shareholder activism, through hostile takeovers, barbarians at the gates. You know that whole story.
All of them wired into the Bloomberg terminal, this fabulous machine with infinite information about bond values, which, are you arguing that became the device of the takeovers?
I'm arguing that he made his money. He profited from the institutions, his partners, his clients. His fortune, therefore, is made off the industry that has done the most to drain opportunity from the American worker and the American dream. So if you are then trying to turn around and say, only I, which is what all how all billionaire sentences start, only I can fix the economy, like you literally made $60 billion from banks that themselves only have that money because that money was not paid in wages and not paid in taxes, right? And once you start to understand that, you know, that money is the fruit of a legal theft. One of the moves that the winners make in the Winners Take All America is first they win at the expense of the society, and then they turn around and market themselves as the solution to the problem they are still working hard to cause. It is the case that they did bad things in the past, and this is the redemption tour. That is the case in some instances. But in many of these instances, the harm doing is concurrent with the redemption. And in that case, taking their money and putting on a museum or a university, you are actually participating, helping them lubricate this engine of ongoing harm doing. And what is remarkable about the last couple of years is there has been a real awakening, I think in part through our politics, for many reasons, a real groundswell of awareness around this. People are starting to wake up to the con. People are realizing, you know, these people aren't just up there because they're smarter than everybody else, right? There's not $62 billion of merit behind Michael Bloomberg. And that's a really important awakening, that behind every fortune, whether or not there's a great crime, there's usually some combination of tax avoidance, lobbying, rigging systems, and wage suppression.
Coming up, Ralph Nader on the sidelines, talking to everybody, sharing his scorecard. This is Open Source. Ralph Nader stands for many things for many people, a model of strong-minded, independent citizenship, also a four-time third-party presidential candidate, still faulted for taking votes from Al Gore against George Bush in the campaign of 2000. For me, over a professional lifetime, Ralph Nader is the best informed reporter on everything that moves in Washington. Ralph, you keep writing books, Fake President, the new one with Mark Green, and you're still going door to door in Congress. Can you account for the air of, I don't know, panic, doom, instability, inscrutability around our politics as Bernie Sanders rises in the standings? People say they have no idea what is happening or where we're going. Tell us, where are we going?
Well, Chris, if they watched our presidential campaign in 2000, they would have seen the precursor. Except when you're a third-party challenger, you're called the spoiler. And when you're a challenger inside the Democratic Party, you're called an insurgent. So
right.
People go to votenader.org, which is the 2008 campaign website, which I've kept open for this purpose, you'll see almost 20 agenda issues that are remarkably similar to those of Bernie Sanders. And what was interesting in that campaign, not to belabor it, is we filled the biggest arenas in the United States, and the other two large candidates couldn't fill any of those arenas. And we had people contributing $20 to get in Madison Square Garden, the Boston Garden, and Target. And so it's very gratifying to see that Bernie is making deep inroads, but we have to be very careful here that the enthusiasm of the youth doesn't correlate very well with turning out the vote. We're going to see 105 to 110 million people not vote, almost 45% of the people are not going to vote in November. And Bernie's right. The only way he's going to win is the biggest voter turnout in our country's history.
Ralph, I want to pick up on that insider-outsider thing. It seems to me, I'm wondering, did Bernie set the trap here for himself, or being a sort of reluctant Democrat, hyphenated Democrat? That's what the party resents him for. His people think he should be awarded the Democratic Party because his insurgency has been hugely popular and important. But how get out of that trap? Franklin Roosevelt, the great innovator, came out of the heart of the Democratic Party. That's where the Democrats, some of them, think the future must come from. He's paying for being outside.
Well, I don't think it's that. I don't think. I mean, the Democratic Party's great scapegoater. They never look at themselves in the mirror. How they keep losing election after election to the worst Republican Party in history. And so they want to say to Bernie, you know, you're not a true Democrat. You're not a registered Democrat. You ran as an independent. That's all frolic and detour. The real reason they don't like Bernie, the Democratic National Committee and the established Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton corporate Democrats, is because he challenges corporate power. He sees the pileup of private wealth with all kinds of freebies in Washington and handouts, and says this is taken from the hide of tens of millions of workers, and we're going to return it, not redistribute it, return it to the workers in the first place, and had it taken away by frozen wages and all kinds of other depredations of the working class. So for example, the economists have pointed out that in the last 25 years, the share that went to capital was much, much greater pace than the share returned to labor. So there's this huge imbalance between what labor gets for its sweat and what capital gets for sitting clipping coupons.
Ralph, in your newsletter recently, you had clearly sat down for a heart-to-heart frank with Nancy Pelosi. Is she resigned to Bernie? Is she trying to stop him? What's her wisdom? What's her interest here?
Well, most of all, she wants to win. She wants to continue becoming the speaker. She wants the Democratic Senate and Democratic president. And if Bernie shows in the polls, and that's what she looks at, that he can beat Trump, and he's been leading Trump in the poll after poll after poll, including in 2016, she'll support Bernie. Bernie's no socialist. A socialist is one who wants government ownership of the means of production. A corporate capitalist is one who wants corporate ownership of the means of government. All Bernie is a Franklin Delano Roosevelt New Deal social democrat. All Bernie is what the social democrats have built in Western Europe, far ahead in livelihood and living qualities and security for the average person than in the U.S. All Bernie is what the major third party in Canada is, the New Democratic Party, the NDP, which at times has won the premiership of Ontario and British Columbia. So Bernie, I consider Bernie a moderate politician, because almost everything he is espousing is supported by a majority of the American people. He wants a living wage. That comes in at 70%. He wants universal health care. That's a majority position. He wants tuition-free education. That's a little controversial, because most Americans don't remember that people who went to CCNY in New York after World War II, or the University of California after World War II, essentially had tuition-free education.
Right.
And he wants to crack down on corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. What's the big deal there? You get 80%, 90% of the people behind that. They want to break up the big banks in New York that are too big to fail. So one after another of his proposals is supported by a majority of the American people, which is the definition of a moderate politician. But the mass media wants to categorize him as a leftist, an extremist, and they're very mischievous in that way.
Let's talk about that. I mean, I understand why the party is very hesitant. He comes out of sort of international socialism. He doesn't say enough that he comes out of Roosevelt, which they think they do. But I don't understand the incredible hostility of the so-called liberal corporate media. What are they afraid of in Bernie Sanders?
Well, that's a puzzling question, Chris, because Trump wants to destroy the First Amendment. He wants to destroy the mass media. He calls them fake news. He calls them all kinds of worse names by newspaper, by television network other than Fox. And you would think they'd really be out to get him. But he's got them intimidated, and they make a lot of money when they transmit his wild, scourging epithets and fulminations.
Stand by for one sec. This Sanders success story so far is driving the mainstream coverage nuts. The New York Times never lets up. Last Sunday, they had that intel leak that some people think Russians are helping Bernie. On the partisan cable news channels, it's just stunning. The voice of Trump on Fox, Sean Hannity, makes Bernie a communist. And Chris Matthews on MSNBC, voice of the Clinton Democrats, goes almost the same way. Listen to this. First, the strategist James Carville, the guy who told Bill Clinton it's the economy, stupid. Now he is saying Putin's hand is showing again. Listen.
The happiest person right now, this thing is going very well for Vladimir Putin. Putin is doing everything that he can to help Trump, including trying to get Bernie Sanders the Democratic nomination.
Bolshevik Bernie Sanders spent decades palling around with some of the most vile, evil, murderous socialist regimes the world has ever seen. This is your new radical extreme socialist Democratic Party that I have been warning you about.
I have my own views of the word socialist, and I'll be glad to share them with you in private. I remember the Cold War. I have an attitude towards Castro. I believe if Castro and the Reds had won the Cold War, there would have been executions in Central Park, and I might have been one of the ones getting executed. And certain other people would be there cheering, okay? So I have a problem with people who took the other side. I don't know who Bernie supports over these years. I don't know what he means by social. One week it's Denmark. We're going to be like Denmark. Okay, that's harmless. That's basically a capitalist country with a lot of good social welfare programs. Denmark is harmless. It's pretty clearly in the Denmark.
Ralph Nader, what is bugging Chris Matthews?
Yeah, well, look, they all see Bernie as basically telling him the party's over.
Yep.
You know, Chris Matthews is a multimillionaire. Hannity is a multimillionaire. They're part of the upper 1%. And they're very comfortable with their corporate sponsors and their corporate facilitators. So let's not look at them in terms of, well, Hannity's a right winger and Chris Matthews is a liberal former aide to Tip O'Neill.
Right. So how should we see them?
We should see them as the corporate class. I mean, they're embedded in the corporate class, embedded in networks and radio and TV stations who get the public airways free, who get all kinds of tax subsidies. I've called Rush Limbaugh a corporate welfare king. He's a freeloader. He said, what the hell does that mean? He says, well, I say, because your radio stations are using the public airways owned by the people free. You don't pay a cent. You're the tenant. We're the landlords, and we don't charge you any rent because your industry has lobbied Congress and the Federal Communications Commission to allow you to use this massive public property free and decide who says what 24 hours a day.
How wounding is that Bolshevik Bernie label, or is it just a joke? Does anybody know who a Bolshevik was?
Well, they're red-baiting Bernie. You know, you've been around long enough, Chris, to know that whenever a progressive emerges, Henry Wallace, they just red-bait him. But that doesn't work anymore Trump is too close to Putin. You see, Trump is a handmaiden of Putin. The Russian oligarchs laundered hundreds of millions of dollars through his overpriced condominiums and other properties. In fact, he praised them before he was running for president. He said they've made him a lot of money.
But all the more, you wonder first who's on first and who's on second on what team. But Chris Matthews trying to ignite a Red Scare, imagining he must have had dreams of being before a Fidel Castro firing squad in Central Park, New York. I mean, that shocks me. It certainly surprised me.
Chris Matthews flipped out a long time ago. When the Iraq War was about to start, the criminal war in Iraq by Bush and Cheney, Phil Donahue and Chris Matthews were on MSNBC. They had different programs. And Phil thought there should be some critics of Bush and Cheney. And NBC said to him, well, we'll let you have one critic if you have three guests that are for the war. This is true. And in the intermission of one of the programs, Chris Matthews came over from his part of the office and said, Phil, why are you un-American? I think you're un-American. So Chris Matthews is vastly overrated as a liberal MSNBC commentator.
Come back to the imagined race between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. How does it play out in your view, Ralph? And what would be winning themes if he could conjure them?
I think the big thing is a parallel citizen movement to get out the vote. You can't depend on the Democratic Party to get out the vote in those seven or eight key states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina. You just can't. They don't know how to bring out the vote. Remember, for all you say about billionaires, Hillary Clinton vastly outspent billionaire Donald Trump and lost the Electoral College. And she didn't know how to get out the vote with all the money in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, or you know, wasn't aware of how to get out the vote. So there has to be a parallel movement that goes door-to-door in the neighborhood, spends time in August, September, October, developing relationships, key influentials in the neighborhood, potluck suppers, why it's important for them to vote, what kind of better life they'll have if they elect certain candidates, and how they can mobilize after the election to be a real force at the grassroots. That's one. The second thing I think that needs to be done is that Bernie has got to collaborate with Elizabeth Warren if he doesn't have enough delegates to the convention in Milwaukee. They've got to join forces in order to beat back the corporate Democrats. And corporate Democrats know their time is up if Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are on the same ticket.
There's another weird thing here, Ralph. Culturally, Donald Trump may well be the worst president ever conceived, but he's been, you know, he's been subjected to intense criticism every single day. The worst imaginable embodiment of American life, leadership, the whole thing. Suddenly, some of the Wall Street Democrats are saying Bernie would be even worse. We have these monsters on the landscape now, and for many people, Mayor Bloomberg would be a third. But how do we make that transition? And I keep wondering, will the big media between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have to make an incredibly awkward choice here, maybe even a switch?
Well, the greedhounds that run Wall Street, corporate power, you know, if they overplay their hand, they'll bring the country down economically. That's happened before. They'll bring it down with a right-wing fascist dictator. Is the American Fuhrer. After he got acquitted by the Senate, he's going into massive rage of vengeance. He's destroying the civil service, purging the civil service. He is slamming back with more impeachable offenses, doubling down against Congress. He's attacking the independence of the judiciary and saying things about specific judges recusing themselves or being ethnically biased, etc., that no president has ever done. He knows he has the press in his hands because they love his ratings and readership. And the unions are scared because a third of them voted for Trump, so that, you know, Trump, the head of the FL-CIO, keeps quieter than he should be, although he makes tough speeches. He doesn't really mobilize people around the White House. There should be peaceful demonstrations day after day around the White House. Wall Street and the business community, he's given them tax breaks. He's given them, free from health and safety regulations. So they like him. And the Republicans in the Senate, he's got them cornered. That they're afraid to break with him and lose the election. So his huge tweet machine is really the media that he is using, because it's a slanderous name by name, nickname by nickname, and rousing massive, ugly responses on the social media against a senator or against a governor or against someone who dares to stand up against him. I'm telling you, if you look at the process here of his concentrating power in the White House, It follows the pattern of many, many former dictators around the world in past decades. The military doesn't like the way he undermines military discipline and pardons bad people, but he gives the military a huge amount of money, so they love it. He once said, as long as he can keep the military and the police happy, nobody can touch him in the White House. While he's dumb as a rock on anything dealing with government agencies, agendas, law enforcement, etc., he's the smartest guy in the country when it comes to the cunning manipulation of power and intimidation. Emphasis, intimidation.
Did you notice Mayor Bloomberg's, to me, rather odd remark out of nowhere that the American military has probably never been more effectively organized and armed in history? Did you notice that?
Well, they have 800 bases inherited from, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, all over the world, maybe 100 countries. I mean, Trump didn't do that. He's into 9 wars, active wars. He inherited most of those active wars. So, you know, when it comes to Trump, I think it's breaking the moral fabric of schools, breaking the moral fabric of families, where youngsters are mimicking him. It is his huge damage, his savage sexual predations against women, his bigoted and racist operations.
Ralph, hold it there for a moment. Coming up, more Ralph Nader and Alex Gurevich. What modern socialism means after all. This is Open Source. There are, of course, many socialisms in modern history and on the modern map. Bernie Sanders defined his own version in his 2016 campaign.
When I talk about democratic socialism, you know what I'm talking about? Social security. One of the most popular and important programs in this country, developed by FDR to give dignity and security to seniors. When I talk about democratic socialism, I am talking about Medicare, a single-payer healthcare system for the elderly. I believe that everybody in this country should be entitled to healthcare as a right, and the most effective way to do it is through a Medicare for All single-payer program. When I talk about democratic socialism, I'm not looking at Venezuela. I'm not looking at Cuba. I'm looking at countries like Denmark and Sweden. And you know what goes on in those countries? All of the kids who have the ability and desire go to college. And you know how much it costs? It is free.
That was Bernie Sanders. Our guest, Alex Gurevich, is a professor of politics at Brown University, and he knows the difference between Denmark's socialism, Bernie Sanders' socialism, and his own. Introduce your politics, Alex.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris.
Pleasure.
Well, my own feelings about socialism are that I think socialism is appealing when we think of it as a way of thinking about freedom. That socialism at its best has been a kind of political philosophy and a movement that is about how to make people free, really in two different ways. One is free from some of the ordinary oppressive kind of impulses in the capitalist economy. Don't, you know, think of universal health care. You don't have to spend hours of your life, days of your life understanding complicated policies, worrying about losing your job and then losing your health care. Having to kind of suck up and deal with a horrible boss just because you need your health care. And that's true of many aspects of socialist policies. So one way in which socialism, I think, is about freedom, and this is my, you know, yes, about my personal view, is because it's a way of emancipating people from having to spend their entire lives working endlessly at dead-end jobs and about them having more control over their work and more time to spend not working. And the second way, and this gets to where I think Sanders is really threatening to people, certain groups, is that it's about freedom because it's about people exercising their democratic power collectively to reorganize the economy. One thing that I think Sanders recognizes, and this is why I like Sanders, one thing Sanders recognizes is that if you really want to restructure the economy, if you really want this generous kind of Western – even if you just want a generous Western European welfare state, you're going to challenge the power and authority of the wealthy, of corporations, of very wealthy billionaires and millionaires. And the only way to then get these policies is to kind of have a fight, you have a conflict. And that requires a mass movement of people who will try and sort of seize control of the economy politically through democratic politics so that it sort of works for them. And
to, the fight you, seems to be on. We're in it.
Yeah.
Two simple questions. Who deep down is so afraid of Bernie and his socialism as to really battle it? And the other one is, why is it seeming to work so comfortably in 2020?
It's a great question. Well, one reason that I think it's been unexpectedly successful is that I think we're at a moment, this is sort of the first moment, when the meaning of socialism is so open. There are some people who think they know what it means. There's some people who don't care about the word. There's other people who think, you know, it could mean a lot of things. But we're far enough away from the Cold War now, multiple generations away from the Cold War, that – and we've had a long enough experience with actually existing capitalism for there to be large groups of people who are open to the possibility of something new, something different. And I think the word socialism, perhaps because it's also a word that's different from, say, communism, at least in American discourse now, has sort of this undefined openness. And so to some, it's the nightmare of the past. But I think for many, it's a word that has not been fully defined. It's not really a fully worked out ideology, actually, for them. That just means another way of organizing the economy, a way that's a bit fairer, more decent, but fundamentally about them having a bit more power over their own lives. And so in a way, it's an ideology that still hasn't been defined.
In case you missed it, Scott Walker in that key state of Wisconsin was governor, wanted to be president, tweets tonight, the goal of socialism is communism. How many of those people are still left?
Yeah. Not nearly as many as Scott Walker would like. But I think, you know, you have to take the memories of people who were sort of fighting political battles during the Cold War and compare them to the experiences of the current economy of most people. Your first guest talked about this. Ralph talked about this. I've been out canvassing for Bernie, and one thing I've noticed, I've canvassed in New Hampshire, I've canvassed in East Boston, I've canvassed in Cambridge, I've made phone calls to New Hampshire and Iowa. Nobody's mentioned, and certainly nobody's even led with, socialism as the reason for or against Bernie. What they've said is, I want something better than what I've got now. I can't stand not being able to pay my health care bills, pay my electricity, pay for all my basic needs. And so they're willing to consider an alternative. They're open to the idea that there is, in fact, real political possibility. They've been told for 30, 20, 10 years, you know, depending on how old they are, that there are no alternatives, that we just have to accept that sort of what you can do with democratic politics is limited. And they just reject that. And I think that's what's driving certain people crazy. That's one thing that's driving people crazy.
You know, somebody had a funny line probably in the Times the other day saying, in effect, Bernie, if Bernie is a moderate, sounds like it to me, he sounds like an Eisenhower era socialist to the right somewhere of Franklin Roosevelt. But if he is that moderate, why do we need a revolution to get it?
Yeah.
Maybe that's for you, Ralph, too.
Yeah. Well, I'll start, I guess.
Ralph, why do we need a revolution to get back to, you know, a happily socialist Eisenhower Federal Highway program?
You're asking me?
Please.
Yeah, because we've had a corporate revolution. We've had a massive corporatization of our political economy, of our elections, our tax system, our education system. We grow up corporate. How many times are we growing up watching ads about new cars? You ever see ads about new public transit on the television?
And it's cultural, so too. The worship of wealth goes everywhere. The financialization of careers, of college education, et cetera. It goes on and on. There is a change.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with Ralph that there's been a kind of corporate revolution, but I think the real reason you need, you might call it a revolution or something like a restructuring, is that that has embedded itself in the structure of the Democratic Party. So Sanders is the only candidate who is taking on, or says he's taking on, the Democratic Party and wants to change its entire structure. I think the Democratic Party's become – people forget it's become an incredibly sclerotic party that doesn't really represent strongly the interests of many people. Under Obama, it got incredibly hollowed out at the national, state, and county level. It lost unprecedented number of governors, mansions, state houses, ended up losing by the end of his term both the Senate and Congress. And what Bernie is doing uniquely, and this is why I think he is in some senses more radical than just his policies, it's his politics. He's willing to call out, give a name to it, call it the Democratic establishment. He's unwilling to conform to its normal rules of discourse. In fact, he's not a Democrat. Right? Everybody knows this. He's an independent. He's willing to call himself a democratic socialist. And he's willing to do all this and mobilize an entire movement behind him that's willing to challenge the existing leadership, its existing norms, its existing understanding of what it's like to be a candidate. And in that sense, it's really the movement politician in him that is the most radical thing about him. It's not just the policies. It's that he recognizes you have to challenge and restructure the entire leadership of the Democratic Party.
Did you mention his self-funding? I mean, I get emails every day asking for
$50. People forget it was one of the defining features that the new Democrats under Clinton was to change the funding model of the Democratic Party, was to say, no, we're going to go to Wall Street, we're going to go to the super wealthy and become not just a corporate but a party funded by the wealthy because it's the only way we can compete with the Republicans. And Bernie has now disproven that that was necessary. And he's sort of called them on it because the kind of the Clintonites and everyone around them always said, well, it won't change our politics. It's just a way of getting money. Obviously wasn't true. But Bernie's the one who's shown that you can fund and generate a mass movement with huge numbers of small contributions. And that is itself a threat. I think you also can't underestimate the kind of aesthetic and rhetorical revulsion of people in the media, the Chuck Todds, the Chris Matthews, all these people who are just losing their minds publicly on television.
Get Tom Friedman in there somewhere.
Well, did he ever totally have his mind? I don't know. But, you know, on public, you know, calling Bernie both like a communist who's going to execute him in Central Park and a Nazi brown shirt, you know, this kind of crazy thing. I think it's they can't stand – they've been so used to being able to police and control the terms of what it's acceptable to talk about in public, how it's acceptable for power to present itself. And Bernie has just sort of defied all of that. You know, he's the guy with one sweater. He doesn't really comb his hair. He always has the one outfit. And it drives them nuts because they keep saying you can't do this, and then people keep voting against them.
You know? Ralph Nader, how much of that portrait of, shall we say, soft socialist Bernie Sanders, independently funded, stubborn, consistent, how much of that satisfies your citizen's heart?
No, this is Bernie's a traditionalist. He believes in government of, by, and for the people, not of, by, and for the corporation. That's the main struggle in America today. It's between the corporate state, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt called fascism in a message in 1938 to the Congress, establishing a committee to investigate concentrated corporate power. I mean, there's nothing new about this. It's just that the Democratic Party, as Alex said, has been surrendering to the commercial interests year after year after year and losing elections to the worst Republican Party in history, an overtly anti-labor, war, Wall Street, party that shouldn't have won any of these races. So, well, we have to get away from these categories. I think Bernie's onto it when he says we have a system of socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I mean, NPR just had a program where this poor man came down with diabetes, and he says he's been spending more time with the drug companies and with all kinds of machinations trying to get the price of insulin down so he can afford it. I mean, this is America, a pay-or-die health care system, so-called, a system where there's no reasonable price controls on drugs, even though our research and development, funded by the taxpayer, has created most of these important drugs, and they've been given to the drug companies, and they charge Americans the highest drug prices in the world because other countries won't let them get away with it. So let's not talk about Bernie as some sort of outlier. The outliers, the extremists, the radicals, against the traditions and pretensions of our constitutional republic, our giant corporations who have disinvested the United States, who have smashed worker pensions, who have hollowed out the country and exported jobs to fascist and communist regimes overseas who know how to put the workers in their place. We've always had, Chris, a mixed system of corporate and public. And so when you talk about socialists in this country, just give me a half a minute. Socialist social security, socialist drinking water departments, socialist post office, socialist firefighters, socialist public lands, socialist public schools, socialist public museums, zoos, municipal electric utilities, public airways, veterans hospitals. What are we talking about? We have free high school, and it's a radical notion to have free tuition in public universities. We had it at CCNY and University of California and elsewhere right after World War II, as I mentioned earlier. Let's get rid of this painting, Bernie Sanders and extremists, the subversions of our constitutional system is the corporatist Donald Trump and his Wall Street buddies who he's given the government to.
I just want to say we've had Boston Common, Ralph, since the 17th century, too. stick with that. And, Alex, another question. Who else does Bernie need? Ralph is a speechwriter, maybe, but in his coalition, mm-hmm. who's required here?
I mean, Bernie's bet is that he can turn out large numbers of people who have otherwise become disenchanted from politics. I think that because he's willing to, take on the Democratic establishment, because he's willing to say he wants to engage in major taxation to fund entitlement programs, he's going to lose some group of wealthy suburbanites. And that means he's going to have to build his kind of new coalition, Democratic Socialist coalition, some other way. And that's going to mean large groups of not just young people, but poor working people of all ages.
Ralph is talking about the categories that these guys get put in, women too. Yeah. You know, Biden's a moderate.
Yeah.
Pete is a moderate. Yeah. There are progressives, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie, and the rest. Is he armored against the – they don't call him an extremist out loud or in print, but they call him left or far left. Mm-hmm. Is that A, damaging, and B, escapable?
Look, I think we don't know. It seems to me that so far he's been pretty immune to every attempt to label him with some kind of scandal. And the red baiting is primarily a kind of media event so far. And if the primaries continue their current trend, it looks like most people are just ignoring these media events. I mean, one of the many reasons I think Ralph said, like, what are they afraid of? I think it's the challenge to their authority. And most people don't have the influence to set the terms of public discourse. They have one form of political power, and that's voting. And so one reason I think this red baiting might not work that much is it just seems to be more noise from the kind of media class. And people just want their universal health care and their free college tuition. And they seem to be happy exercising the one kind of political power they have, which is their vote. So I think it's turned out to so far be not that particularly effective.
Ralph, in a word, how does he escape the – what's to say, the isolation that George McGovern suffered? A farm boy, Protestant minister, flyer in World War II, who became a pariah for opposing the war in Vietnam.
Well, Bernie's got to broaden his speeches, and his surrogates have got to broaden his speeches. He's got to show that people have been stolen their hard-earned earnings, that when you have a frozen minimum wage, you're stealing from a worker. Inflation gutted, productivity gains not going back to the worker. When you steal from corporate pensions, you're stealing from retirement securities. When you're transferring public wealth into private domains like the public lands and the public airways and the massive trillions of dollars of government research and development that built almost all the modern industries in this country, from aerospace to pharmaceuticals to biotech, to nanotech, to computers, to Silicon Valley, to the containerization industry. Then people begin to realize that all Bernie's asking for is payback.
Ralph, you've still got your fastball. Thank you, Ralph Nader. His new book titled Fake President. Thank you, Alex Gurevich and Anand Giridharadas. We go out this hour remembering the late Lyle Mays, keyboardist and composer, literally the right and left hands of Pat Metheny across 30 years. He was an 11-time Grammy winner who quit the music business to write code. Among his last gifts was a computer program to play live with his band's improvisations. Farewell and thank you, Lyle Mays. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.